Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Stage 9, Trek FM's show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're going to be talking about Star Trek Beyond. It's finally here.
It got here ready and raring to go beyond.
After all this time talking about the people who were involved in the making of the movie, now to actually see the finished project all put together, it's something. So we're going to give our personal thoughts on the movie, just like everybody else. But then the angle that we're going to take is to see what we think about Justin Lin's contribution as director and Simon Pegg and Doug Jung's contributions as writers and J.J. Abrams' contribution as producer.
Yeah.
So
that's our thing.
Yeah. And we have a lot of news as well, obviously, but we're going to start off with Beyond and work our way into the news. Let's start off with Beyond. We're going to work under the assumption that anybody listening to a deep cut podcast on the Trek FM network a week after the release of the first movie in over 3 years will have seen the movie. So spoilers, spoilers, spoilers for everyone.
Yeah. Not holding anything back. Nope.
But for those people who may not have seen it and want to live on the edge, do you want to give a brief synopsis of this film? Or
yes.
I should say movie, since it was shot digitally.
Okay, the thrust of this movie is that Jim Kirk is feeling a little bit, he's questioning his role in Starfleet and the world. It's his, you know, it's coming up on his birthday. He doesn't like to make a big deal about it. And life is feeling a little bit stagnant to him. He's looking at new opportunities. He's even put in a request to be promoted to vice admiral. And of course, as always with Star Trek, one last mission shows up before the decision can be made about his promotion. And it's an intriguing mission about an alien race that has been ambushed and lost their ship, and they need help getting their crew. And of course, things are never what they seem. And so they go beyond the nebula in front of them and encounter an enemy ready and willing to wipe them out.
Yes. So, what did you think about it?
I thought it was kinetic. I thought it was fun. I laughed out loud. I really, truly enjoyed this. And I truly enjoyed... No lie, I know that this is a charged comment because Into Darkness is still a relatively divisive movie among the fan base. But this was the sequel that I feel I deserved back when Into Darkness came out. This is what I wanted to see. There was forward movement with the characters. There was forward movement with the story. There was a lot of movement on screen, which I thought was beautifully handled, compellingly put together. Is it a five-star Godfather movie? No. But is it the most fun I've had at a Star Trek movie in years? Yes. Did I feel that the character development was handled really well? Yes. Is the movie a success? Yes. I think Justin Lin should be proud. And what did you think?
I liked it a lot. I was a little nervous going into it, as I always am going into a Star Trek movie, and that first viewing is always kind of like almost, you know, sort of like looking at it through the analytical eye that you normally look at a movie with on a second viewing, because I'm like, I'm so caught up and I'm like, please make sure you don't do anything that breaks this, you know? And then it's like, once I sort of like get to the end and I'm like, okay, yeah, that's good. Then on the second viewing, I can sort of like relax and just watch it.
Yeah.
I thought it was very good. I, you know, the comments which I'm seeing coming out of everything is like, this is the movie that I've been waiting for. This is the best of the Kelvin timeline movies. You know, this is certainly, you know, what they should have been doing from the beginning and all this stuff. And I honestly don't agree with any of that. I think that this is by far the least good of the Kelvin timeline movies.
Oh, nuts. That's a crazy comment. I can have an argument with you about 09 versus... I don't think that this movie can exist outside of 09. I think that this movie is... And I've never beaten up 09. I'm perfectly happy with 09. I thought that 09 was a great job of reestablishing everything and getting it started again. And I thought that it was, you know, it too was fun and kinetic and worth watching. This, Into Darkness, the biggest problem I had with it that I still have with it is that it's stagnant. It just feels like it's stuck in place, that it's just taking 09 and saying, okay, let's tweak a few things and yeah, here's the movie. Whereas this feels like, okay, well, we know where they have been. Let's, forgive me for this, let's push beyond that and take them to the next level that we all want to get them to. That's why I say this is the sequel that I wanted. Is it better than 09? You know, that's splitting hairs to me. But it's definitely, I mean, my initial reaction is that it's as good as, but even though it can't exist, like this is the type of sequel that can't really exist outside of it. Like, you need 09 going into this to truly grasp everything that's going on. Do I think somebody could come into it cold like my wife? Probably. And she'd do okay with it. Because I don't think that there's anything so big that, you know, breaks that. But it would be like showing Dark Knight Rises to somebody who hasn't seen Batman Begins or The Dark Knight. They'd be like, oh, well, that's a good movie, but wait, who was that two-faced guy again? You know, like, it's that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I see what you're saying. And I guess, yeah, my biggest complaint with Into Darkness was really that it did, like, I feel like with 09, you know, they were obviously setting up this new timeline. And I think the way that it ends, especially with, you know, the opening of the original series in a lot of ways, is kind of like saying, okay, we did it. We got us back to where we wanted to be. We got us back to where everyone wants us to be. And now we can go off onto our 5-year mission. And then with Into Darkness, I feel like, you know, they did say like, oh, okay, and with this movie, we are going to show how they got onto their 5-year mission. It's like, well, didn't we just see that? I think we just saw that, you know, and I can totally see that criticism, and I have that criticism of the movie, but I think that Into Darkness has a lot of other stuff going on in it, which is really, really interesting. And I mean, the interesting thing about it is, like, for the past 3 years, I've sort of questioned my love for Into Darkness, not because I didn't love it, but because of everyone else's criticisms of it.
Sure.
And my thinking, like, internally, I've never said this out loud, but I'll say it out loud now, is, you know, maybe the only reason why I like Into Darkness is just because it's the newest, least familiar Trek. And, you know, just like with anything, just like with Episode 7, for example, you know, we've all seen the other 6 movies 15,000 times, so we're going to get more out of a viewing of Episode 7 than we are out of any of the other Star Wars movies. So we're going to watch it a bunch, right? And we're going to enjoy watching it more than we're going to enjoy watching The Empire Strikes Back, even though Empire is clearly a better movie, you know? But when I was watching this, I had a sort of a unique experience. I saw the movie on its own. I saw Beyond on its own. And then the next day I went to the trilogy marathon at a Navy Pier. And I saw, you know, all 3 films back to back in IMAX. And what I found was that in a lot of ways, my not being over the moon for Beyond sort of legitimized my personal love for Into Darkness, because now Beyond is the newest thing, right? Beyond is brand new, and Into Darkness is, you know, that thing that's been around for 3 years. And yet I was still more invested in watching Into Darkness than the movie which I had only seen once mere hours before. You know what I mean?
I completely understand what you're saying. And so I would say that possibly then playing into my reaction to Beyond is that I did not have that reaction to Into Darkness. And I mean, so when Beyond you know, appears before me, I too went in with the trepidation of, oh man, this could go wrong. And again, it's not perfect. It's not perfect. But the highest compliment I can give is that this, even though it's in the Kelvin timeline, I do agree with the comments. This feels like my Star Trek, you know, quote unquote, my Star Trek. This has the tone, but while at the same time being a Justin Lin movie. This is a Justin Lin movie. There's no doubt to me. Like, I can't confuse this style or this storytelling technique, even though it's comfortable in the same universe as the way that Abrams did it. Even though it's comfortable there, I can tell that a different director is there. And I can enjoy that. It's still his movie. And since I like Justin Lin movies, there you go.
And we'll get into that in just a second. I guess the one thing that I would say in terms of Beyond and sort of just, because I know I sound like I'm coming down, you know, semi-hard on it, and I don't want that to be the case. You know, I mean, it did not blow me away like I hoped it would. I don't think it's the best movie of the year. I don't think it's better than 10 Cloverfield Lane. You know what I mean?
No, I agree with that. But were you expecting a transcendent Trek experience?
I'm always expecting a transcendent Trek experience. And the fact that I got one the last two times out, I was really hoping for it here. I certainly, you know, watching the trailers and everything, I had my doubts. And the main one being like, okay, they blow up the ship, you know, a third of the way into the movie, and I didn't have a problem with, you know, conceptually them blowing up the ship, but I knew what that meant was they were going to be spending basically the entire movie on that planet. And I mean, one of the things which, you know, I thought of, you know, going into, you know, when was Star Trek Beyond, I mean, 2 years ago, and we'll talk about this later on, but 2 years ago we interviewed J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, who were writing the new movies. Mm-hmm. And they said, okay, we're going to turn around the questioning here. What do you want to see out of the next Star Trek movie? And the thing that I said was, I want to see Captain Kirk on the bridge actually captaining a starship, you know, because every chance they have to get him off the bridge of that ship and have him running around on some planet or shooting some guy or jumping on something, they do, you know? And it's like, he's got that chair there. It looks really comfortable. Let's have him sit in it for a while and command a starship. And that was lacking from the first two movies, and that's really lacking from this one because, you know, they spend most of the time on the planet. And by spending so much time on the planet, I feel like the movie feels much smaller than I would have hoped for something which is like a 50th anniversary movie. I want like this grand epic scale storytelling that you see in a lot of other movies. And just one more thing about that. And this is, you know, I guess will somewhat lead into Justin Lin's directing too, is like when they're down on the planet, it's great, it's fun and everything, and I enjoy it. But anytime they're up in space, I'm like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. I mean, the destruction of the Enterprise was fantastically done. Yes. And that sequence at the end with the Franklin, the sabotage sequence, mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the best things ever in any Star Trek movie. I loved that scene so much.
It was pretty great.
You know, and it's like when we see that, we get this little taste at the beginning and at the end. It's like, I want Justin Lin to make another Star Trek movie where, you know, this time the big thing was like, we can't have them go to Earth. They've got to be out in deep space. Next movie, Justin Lin directs, the rule, they're not allowed to leave the ship. They've got to stay on the ship the entire time. That's the movie I want to see
given
next.
Given that Payne and McKay are writing the next one, you may get your wish.
You never know.
You know. Well, okay. I understand what you're saying, and I will respectfully disagree because I think that the nicest thing to get for a 50th anniversary movie is to get something that breaks down and appreciates the characters and gives you a true appreciation for who they are in relation to each other and the character moments. I don't care whether they're on the bridge or not. I feel that this, of the Kelvin timeline movies, I finally felt like Kirk was a captain like I understood why people listened to him. He was intelligent. He was decisive without being authoritative. Authoritarian. He listened, like he got the best out of everybody. And they put him in these situations that really highlighted that. And I really liked that about this movie. And I actually really enjoyed, I mean, the Spock and Bones interaction scenes when they're off alone, beautiful, man. I mean, it's like those scenes alone were the moments where I was so immersed in it. And I said, whoever, you know, obviously not talking to myself in the theater, but it's that you get a wash in that feeling of the people who made this movie get it. They understand where the strength of all of this is. And it's in these character moments that exist. The story that's going on frames everything, and you get your, and I agree with you. The sabotage sequence was fantastic. I loved it. I was giggling through the whole thing. I was like, yes. And when, I mean, you know, when Scotty comes in and it's Fight the Power is playing, I guffawed in the theater, and it was such a great moment. But you know, he can be on the bridge and not reflect like in the previous two movies, like in Into Darkness, I was like, he still doesn't feel like he belongs in that chair. Whereas with this, I felt like he belonged leading people. Like I could understand the loyalty.
So, yeah. Although it is weird though, that they reach this point where it's like, this is the first time that Captain Kirk feels like he actually deserves to be captain. And they're like, now we're going to make him an admiral. And it's like, wait a minute. No, he does not. No, he's not admiral yet. Are you kidding me? What are you talking about?
Vice admiral.
Okay. Vice admiral.
And whatever. He was applying because, and again, that ties into the beautiful character scene of, he was questioning it. You know, I mean, in a sense, it's something that I think a lot of people can relate to, where you're sort of, you know, you go into your job every day, you know, he says it feels episodic. It's the same day in and day out. And you sit there sometimes and you wonder, yeah, should I be going for the promotion? What am I supposed to be doing right now?
Yeah.
You're trying to figure things out. And, you know, I guess the point of attack for people's reactions to it will probably be based on how much they liked Into Darkness.
I mean, that might be. In a lot of ways, I think it's good that they got away from the people who made the last two movies, because I feel like the people who made this movie aren't very precious about the last two. In fact, I get the impression that they don't even like Into Darkness themselves.
You mean by the fact that you can completely ignore it?
By the fact that you can completely ignore it, by the fact that, you know, Simon Pegg is on Twitter saying, in a couple months, we're going to go beyond darkness or out of the darkness, you know, things like that. I mean, yeah, I think that they didn't like, I mean, JJ has even said that, you know, he's not super happy with it. So, you know, I think that's good, that by getting away from the people who, you know, created this current mythology, in a sense, mm-hmm. I think that you open yourself up to other ideas, and instead of trying to continue storylines which maybe should be dropped, you're dropping them and just doing your own thing.
Okay, but see, that spurs for me an interesting question then, because let's say Episode 7 never happens. In our timeline, we're living in the Episode 7 timeline, but the red matter never fires, and so J.J. Abrams stays on because the success of Into Darkness would sort of demand he stays in the director's chair, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the sequel, they'd want him on there. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, how do you see this going differently if Abrams is still in the director's chair? I mean, even you are willing to acknowledge that there were some things that didn't fire quite. He acknowledges there are things that didn't fire quite right with Into Darkness. Do you see the same sort of refreshing factor that this brings with a different crew?
I don't know if it is going to be as refreshing, but I think at the same time, it'll be more skillfully made. And I know that that's going to sound really bad. That's not a knock on Justin Lin at all.
That sounds awful though. What on earth do you mean by that?
It's not a knock on Justin Lin at all, because I mean, we just did a whole freaking series on Justin Lin and how awesome his movies are. But as I've said on numerous occasions, I think that J.J. Abrams is one of the best filmmakers working today.
You think he takes this script and makes something better than what Justin Lin made?
I don't think he takes this script. I think he takes a different script. You know?
So he directs Payne and McKay's script?
I don't know what he does. I don't think he does, because I think he's the one who got rid of the Payne and McKay script, but I think he comes up with something else. You know, I don't know what he does. I really don't. But I think whatever it is going to be pretty spectacular.
See, and I think we should table the discussion, because I think I've figured out why Abrams should not direct sequels to his own work.
Okay.
But I feel like that's a much bigger discussion, and it's going to cause you to be angry at me. So what did you think of Justin Lin? I mean, what did you think, though, separating it from the comparison to Abrams? What did you think of Lin's direction?
I thought it was amazing. I mean, like I was saying before with the space stuff, I was just constantly blown away by the images on screen. I mean, these were, like, the first time I watched it, I was repeatedly just sort of in awe of the visuals and kept on thinking to myself, like, I've never seen anything like this in a Star Trek movie before. I've never seen anything like this. You know, maybe once when they got down to the planet, I was like, yeah, this is all kind of familiar. But like the space stuff, which you would think would be the hardest thing to make unique, because we've seen how many thousands of space battles, you know, over the years, over the past 50 years. And yet he made the space stuff so unique. I mean, just aesthetically, you know, the design of the Yorktown is amazing, you know, and the way that he moves the camera through it. Even just like skillful little things like during the captain's log sequence, you know, where he's talking about, you know, the life or whatever, that little montage is very well done and is very well, you know, written, and sort of like you get like lots of things like everything's feeling episodic and it's like, oh, that's funny. You know, you get the, you know, the shot of Kirk opening up his closet and seeing the same, you know, shirts over and over again. But then you also have like things where it's just like a little touch where it's like, it just shows the effort which he puts into little details when he says, like, you know, the crew has, you know, led the crew to some interesting interactions, some for the better. And then they show like the two crew members like hooking up, you know, like kissing and closing the door. And then it says, and some for the worse. And then you see, you know, the Orion, you know, girl throwing, you know, Chekhov out of the thing. And, you know, most people would be like, I mean, that is a very sort of typical, like, you know, point and counterpoint, you know, and you would expect to see those two things. And but the way that he does it is like, these two crew members in close-up go into this room, the door closes, and then the camera whip pans over to this. I mean, it's all in one shot, you know? Yep. And then you see, like, point and counterpoint in the same hallway. And, like, that stuff, like, that attention to detail, I'm like, wow, you know, that's what sets Justin Lin apart from most directors. You know, he thinks of things very, very visually, you know, everyone's like, well, he's a huge action director, so he's going to be great at action. It's like, yeah, he's going to be great at action, but he's not just a huge action director. He's a very, very visual director, and he's going to, you know, move the camera in a manner which is, you know, unparalleled, really. It's kind of amazing. Yeah. And
I completely agree with you. And with the camera movement on the Yorktown when it spins around. I just recently read for the first time Ringworld by Larry Niven, and it was very evocative of the way things are described in that, where it's like you're walking along and there's a giant ring above you, and the way that he did the action with the zero G fight, but also the fight on the Enterprise as the hallways are turning around.
There,
you know, I will give Into Darkness when the ship's falling apart and they're running through the hallways. That was kind of, you know, that was neat. I was like, oh, that's clever. Whereas this took that and made it even more insane, like to the point where it almost took me out to say, how did they pull that off? I wanted the magician to show me how they did the trick, because I was so like flabbergasted by the way that Kirk flew across and the floor moved and he went through, you know, like that was so neat. And even when they were going through the, you know, going through the saucer section and spinning things around was just, you know, that's some special stuff happening right there.
There's the shot where it's such a beautiful shot. Kirk gets into the escape pod and you're looking out the window over his shoulder, and you, as he ejects, and you see the Enterprise fall, you know, away from him, you know, and then the camera racks focus and you see his reflection in the window. There's so much going on in that shot, but just the idea of, it's like we've set up that these pods are shooting off the Enterprise because we're seeing it with the camera essentially on the Enterprise as they're being shot off. Now we're going to turn it around, and just the idea of, like, I mean, for one thing, it's just the emotional moment for Kirk where it's like he's losing his ship, you know, but also just the idea of, like, we were literally, like, the camera and Kirk were literally on the ship mere seconds ago, and now it is way, 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 way down there about to crash into the ground. And it's like, you know, that's awesome. It's, I mean, that is like masterclass filmmaking right there, you know?
Agree.
Yeah.
Agree.
So, okay. I mean, where do you think this this kind of fits into his filmography? Do you see? I mean, not necessarily in terms of ranking it, but
I see a Justin Lin who has confidently made Fast Five, whereas the ending of Furious Six got a little out of hand. I think that this is more evocative of his knowing when to go like super big and then not go too far. Not have, you know, like the ending of Fast and Furious 6 is, it's a little much. It gets a little out of control. So I think this shows that he has learned his lessons from, you know, Fast and Furious 6, and then he pulls back a little bit and has a tighter control over things. That, like, this is that Justin Lin to me. This is the Fast Five Justin Lin is what I'm seeing at play here.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I still think that Fast Five is his best movie, but this is, I mean, a close second for me. And, you know, I think it's interesting that he is kind of able to stretch his legs in a different medium and that sort of thing, and balance, you know, character stuff with, you know, big action set pieces, which is what, you know, he did in a lot of his movies. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's pretty spot on. Now, what about the script, Simon Pegg and Doug Jung? Do you see anything about that which sort of like signals them?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, Doug Jung, again, we only did Confidence, so it's hard to, you know, really. But, you know, there's that whole switch at the end of this, you know, the surprise at the end about, you know, the villain's origins and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that it, you know, it's sort of constructed like that. I think that this is, in terms of what Simon Pegg has written, it's appropriately meta at the right points. And I was talking with somebody else. I was talking with a friend of mine who just saw it. And what I said to him was, suspiciously, Scotty's role seemed to be really big in this movie, comparatively speaking. And then I just paused for a second and I said, but of course, if I wrote a movie, it would be the John Mills show through the entire thing. So I'm not begrudging him that.
Yeah, I guess I was kind of surprised by that because I kind of thought he'd be like, I don't want to, you know. But then thinking about it, like, he's always the star of his movie, so it does make sense to a certain.
Well, extent. I also took it. I don't know if this is intentional or not, but Scotty's whole escape from the Enterprise very much struck me along as a James Bond tribute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like that is what that struck me as. And if that was intentional, great. If it was unintentional, still great.
Yeah. So. I mean, I think like the big thing, like, cause it doesn't feel like any of his other movies, like on a tonal level. I mean, there's some mm-hmm. humor, but it's not, you know, as jokey as his other stuff, which is to be expected. I think, you know, in addition to sort of like a lot of, you know, nerdy references, which you wouldn't normally get. Like, for example, the giant green hand, you know, conversation.
Yes.
Which, did you notice the giant green hand in the credits at the end of the movie?
No, I didn't see it.
It took me. I think I noticed it on my third viewing. But yeah, like at one point you see like a giant green hand reach for the Enterprise or something. But I think the thing that they keep on talking about, which is that this is sort of like a deconstructionist view of Star Trek, I think that is something which he does a lot. You know, he did that with the zombie genre. He did that with, mm-hmm. you know, all of the movies in the Cornetto trilogy. And, you know, I think we're seeing that here just in a much more specific way. You know, it's not about a genre. It's about, you know, a franchise. And, you know, I think that's very interesting on a conceptual level. And that's sort yeah. of like the biggest trademark of his that I see in this script. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I do want to say that I think a special shout out. If I were in charge of the nominating committee, I would give the costumes in this an Oscar nomination. I'm no lie. I thought that these were wonderfully tweaked versions of the costumes. I loved everything that they did with the, you know, the Enterprise costumes, their outfits when they were on the planet were great. I love those jackets. Like that whole outfit was great to me. Like, I know that it seems strange, but I paid special attention to the costumes. I thought they were all wonderfully done.
That, you know, they're definitely growing on me. I mean, the jackets, I think, are amazing. You know, yeah, I mean, I thought that the costumes were decent. I thought that the production design was outstanding. You know, I really loved, yeah. you know, sort of the look of this. As far as the cinematography was concerned, I mean, I thought that the camera movement and everything was great, although I wasn't really a big fan of the lighting per se. And I know.
Yeah, I get that. For me, the one scene that jumped out as difficult to watch was when Scotty was in, when he was trying to get power back to the engines when they were under attack, mm-hmm. and the camera was moving around. Like it was hard to visually focus on him when he was in that little, that, like, that's just the first thing that popped out at me.
I know, like, I read a thing with the special effects people where they were talking about they were really trying to sort of grunge up the movie because that's sort of like the aesthetic that Justin Lin likes. He likes to have that sort of dirty, lived-in look. And they also talk about how, you know, he wanted to give it sort of like a filmic look, even though it was shot digitally. And I always think that that's a mistake. I mean, you can totally tell that they were trying to do it. It looks like there was like a lot of artificial grain and stuff like that. But I mean, I just wish they would let digital be digital. I wish they would have let him yeah. shoot it on film and, you know, have it look like film. But yeah, I've seen it. I've seen it in both 2D and 3D. The 3D is honestly a mess. I think they were just too rushed. I don't think they had enough time to do the conversion properly, but it looks a lot better to me in 2D, and I got to see it in the Dolby Vision with the laser projectors.
Oh yeah, how was that?
It looks fantastic. Check it out. Good. It's so good, so good.
I just saw it in a run of the mill movie theater digitally, though, of course, and I thought, you know, overall it looked good.
Yeah, it makes me sad that this is the first Star Trek movie which I won't see on film. So a little tear, but what can you do?
Yeah, not much.
So okay, final point here. This is a J.J. Abrams production, even though he did not direct it himself. So what do you think makes it that, you know, we looked at all the movies which he produced for other people. Do you see the Bad Robot stamp on here?
Yeah, I kind of do. Right. But can I give a truly honest answer considering they're using a ship design and you know, that's Abrams's, you know, the one that he shepherded through and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But, in terms of, I mean, I think we've said it before, like the hallmark of a Bad Robot production is that you can tell that the resources were available. There was no like corner cutting, as it were. Now, maybe there was corner cutting with a 3D conversion, but I'll never know because I don't see movies in 3D. So there you go.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think the thing that that really stands out to me, aside from that, you know, what you're saying, I totally agree with. I also think that we kind of see what we saw with Mission Impossible, and the thing that you keep on hearing from people associated with the production is he kept on telling the people involved, and Justin Lin in particular, like, make this your own movie. And I think that that's really, really admirable for someone who's talking to the guy who's taking over the franchise, which you built up yourself, you know, to say, like, don't be beholden. Because there's a lot of people, we won't name names, but, you know.
I know who you're talking about, and I got no problem with it. Go ahead.
There's a lot of
people. Drop the name. Drop the name. Bring it.
There's a lot of people who maybe want to use filmmakers, directors who are working on their properties as sort of like proxies for themselves. And they want a certain level of consistency, which maybe limits creativity on the set to one degree or another. That doesn't...
That's no way to talk about Walt Disney, Mike.
That does not seem to be what happened here with Star Trek Beyond. It seems like Lin instead was constantly being pushed by Abrams to do things differently and to make things unique. And I think that that's really super cool. And I think that the movie is much better for it. You know, even though I don't, like I said, I don't like Lin's aesthetic as much as I like Abrams's, the last thing that I would want to see is Lin trying to do Abrams. I want Lin needs to be Lin, you know? And what we're going to get is something which is fantastic. And that's what we got. And I think that's really cool. So any final thoughts on Beyond?
Everybody listening to this has seen it by now, right? Go see it a second time if you want to. Indulge yourself. You got some time until Suicide Squad comes out, so go for it.
Yeah, go for it. I've seen it 3 times now. I've enjoyed it each time, and I'm definitely going to be seeing it some more times. So a very, very, very good movie. All right, so you know, Star Trek Beyond, right? Okay, it's here. It's over. It's done. Let's move on to the next Star Trek movie, because that's the way these things work, right?
Yes.
Now, last week we had a conversation which was very interesting at the time and very thought-provoking for about 10 hours.
Yes.
Until they officially, you know, announced that Star Trek 14, Star Trek Forever, is going to be made, and Chris Hemsworth is, you know, for sure 100% locked down. And they revealed that the script is being written by J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay. I talked a little bit about this. I recorded a little intro to the last episode just so that we don't sound like total idiots. But delving into this a little deeper, Payne and McKay have never had anything produced, but they've written a ton of movies, a ton of scripts, including the script for Star Trek 13, which was not used, that they wrote along with Roberto Orci when he was planning on directing it. This script is not a modified version of theirs, from what everyone involved has said. It's a completely different script. So apparently whatever they did, even though it didn't work for this particular movie, it was good enough that Abrams hired them to write the next one.
But think about it, that Star Trek has a fine tradition. Everybody knows the two pilots story for the original series. They're getting their second chance the way Roddenberry got his.
Yeah.
So there you go. It's a fine Trek tradition to recognize quality talent and say, you know what, this one doesn't work. Try again, make a couple of, you know, changes to your approach and let's see how it works out. And apparently it's going to work out fine.
Apparently it is. J.J. Abrams just the other day gave an interview where he was talking about this new movie, and he says that it's the best story that they've had so far out of the four movies.
Well, yes, but Abrams is also a producer and well-versed in, you know, sort of the P.T. Barnum school that goes along with movie production. Because he said the same thing with the episode 8 script, where he said, "Oh, I wish I was directing it because it's the greatest script I've ever seen." So you know, let's temper expectations a little bit on that one.
I guess so. But when you're out promoting a movie and you're like, yeah, I'm here to tell you to go see this movie, but, you know, if I'm going to be completely honest, it's not as good as the one that we're making now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I guess, you know, people are like, ooh, but to me, it's almost like you're saying like, you know, you can just wait for the next one.
No.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, regardless of that, I'm super excited about this. You know, as we mentioned, you know, before we had Payne and McKay on commentary Trek Stars. I looked, it was 2 years ago. That's how long this process has been going on. 2 years ago, we talked to them about Star Trek 13, and obviously they couldn't tell us anything about what it was they were actually doing, but we really did sort of get into their fandom and everything and what led them to writing the script and also how they were planning on addressing some concerns that, you know, people had with Into Darkness and that sort of thing. And it's really interesting to hear what they have to say. So go check it out. It's commentary, Trek Stars number 87. It's called Yes And.
And to entice people further, I'm not on that episode.
There you go.
So if you don't like my voice, truly the episode of commentary Trek Stars to listen to.
But check it out because, I mean, you know, a lot of people don't know much about them since they haven't seen any of their work. But, you know, it's if you want an idea of who's writing the next Star Trek movie, check out the interview. All right. So now that shameless plug is over, I guess we should move on to some other news about the new Star Trek TV show.
Oh, was there news? Did something happen with the new Star Trek show?
Maybe. Yes, San Diego Comic-Con did happen, just like we were talking about, and there was some news revealed, and that news is that the show is called Star Trek Discovery.
Yay!
Perhaps the worst-kept secret in Hollywood, but you know what? it was, if you go back, you can look. It was all over Twitter before the thing was announced. It seemed like everyone knew about it, but... Star Trek Discovery is the name of the show. Now, one of the things which is really interesting, which was sort of revelatory to a lot of people, I think, was that they showed the ship. They showed a little video of the ship. And the design of the ship is rather unique, wouldn't you say?
I thought it was wonderful. And yes, unique is a great, great word for it.
It has a Star Trek history to it for sure.
Yes, it does. But the thing is, speaking as somebody who didn't look at it through that, like it, as I was watching it, that didn't trigger. It was sort of like afterwards. I enjoyed the reveal because it is, you know, maybe there's something rubbing off on me from you over these last several years, but it was, I looked at it and I said, it's different. It's not just the same thing. They're not trying to out-sleek themselves. This ship has its own identity, its own feel, its own flow and its own durability. And then of course, you know, the history of the design, the possible history of the design.
You know, the first, you know, almost as soon as the thing was revealed, everyone started saying, like, look, it looks just like this ship that Ralph McQuarrie designed for an unmade Star Trek movie from, like, 1975, The Planet of the Titans, which is a very interesting lost Star Trek film, which Drew and I actually talked to John Tenuto about on Standard Orbit. But yeah, they brought in McQuarrie, who of course is the guy who did a lot of the design work for Star Wars, you know, the original trilogy. And a lot of his unused designs were used as the basis for the look of Star Wars Rebels.
And the Clone Wars. There were some of his earlier designs, and actually there were some earlier designs of his that crept up in the prequels too.
Yeah, that's definitely true. Although Rebels looks like a Ralph McQuarrie painting to me, anyway. I mean,
no doubt. Like Lothal comes straight out of his Alderaan paintings from the 1970s, and some of the ship designs are just straight literal, you know, translations of early concepts of his. Absolutely, yes.
It's such gorgeous work. He's such a great artist. I mean, he was like going way, way, way back to like when I was a kid, before I knew anything about who the people were who made movies. Like Ralph McQuarrie is one of the very, very first names that I actually knew, and one of the people whose work I knew. There was this great set, which maybe you had too, from Return to the Jedi, where it was like substantially sized like pieces of art, like in a book, but in an envelope from his concept art for Return of the Jedi. And oh my god,
yeah, there was, yes, McQuarrie stuff was out there. I still have the Return of the Jedi sketchbook from the 80s. No, I will never sell it. McQuarrie was amazing in terms of what he put out for, you know, and he was incredibly influential, I think, to the direction of a lot of series. I don't have my finger on the pulse of everybody's reaction to the ship that's been revealed for Discovery. I think that, yes, it looks like McQuarrie's, but there are some tweaks to it that are evocative to me of a Klingon D7 and the NX series, and the fact that it's not like that white grayish color.
Yeah.
Like maybe that's what's selling me on it immediately. Is I'm like, oh, finally something else than just that same color for a ship.
It's a really cool looking ship, and the thing about it, I mean, I guess, like it's definitely there's not only a McQuarrie influence, but I mean, there's definitely they are going out of their way almost. Like you look at the ship and you're like, that looks very similar, but you know, there are some tweaks to it for sure. And you think, well, maybe it's coincidence. I don't know, but the pulling out of the asteroid thing,
yes,
that is from like another painting that he did. And the thing which really sort of makes it like indisputable is those two little blue lights on the side, that those are in his painting, you know? And during the press conference, someone asked, you know, Brian Fuller, like, was McQuarrie an inspiration? And he's like, yeah, for sure. I'm not exactly sure how much. We're still trying to figure that out legally or something along those lines.
They don't want another H.R. Giger situation as what happened with 20th Century Fox.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. I mean, yeah, it's really cool. And I love the fact that they're digging deep into this, you know, sort of archive and pulling out this very, very unique design for this ship. It makes me very happy.
So, but could you understand if somebody didn't like the ship?
Sure, because it looks weird, you know?
Yeah.
It's weird and offbeat, and it's not like every other ship. And I mean, I think a lot of people probably had the same reaction to Deep Space Nine when they saw that, you know?
And no, that's true.
And the thing that people could say, you know, back then is like, well, it's alien. You know, it's supposed to look weird. It's supposed to be offbeat, you know? And this one, you know, maybe you could say like, well, it's a Federation ship and Federation ships have a certain aesthetic and this is, you know, bizarre. But I like the fact that it is so unique. It does not look like all the other Enterprises, and yet it's still, you know, definitely Federation in design. It's got the saucer section, it's got the nacelles, and I really do like the way that this ship looks, I have to say.
For me, I really like it just because it looks durable.
Yeah.
It looks like the type of ship you send into deep space. And you kind of are accepting, like there's nothing on it that looks like it's delicate. It looks like, you know, if an asteroid hits it, it'll affect it, but not everybody's going to die immediately. You know, this is the type of ship I would step on and be like, all right, I feel okay about flying out there in this.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It's a cool looking ship. The other piece of news, which was revealed, apparently according to Deadline, the director of the pilot is going to be David Semel, if I'm pronouncing that right.
Is that how it's pronounced?
I don't know. How would you pronounce it?
I would have said Semel.
All right. Well, we'll say both. And then that way,
okay,
one of us will be right.
We're covered.
Now, you know, prior to this, it certainly appeared that Alex Kurtzman was going to be directing the pilot, even though there wasn't an official announcement. He was listed on the IMDb, and he was listed in Mark Worthington, the production designer's resume, as the director of the pilot. And, you know, I have a feeling that he was planning on directing it, and with the mummy creeping up on him, he's like, yeah, there's no way that this is happening. But maybe that was just, you know, misinformation too. Who knows? I don't know. But he's not doing it. It's David Semel.
Semel.
He is a very, very prolific television director. He was nominated for the pilot for Heroes, which, you know, this is becoming a really big Heroes reunion, apparently.
Yeah, it is.
And,
it is.
You know, say what you want about Heroes, and God knows I have, but one thing that I always said about that show was, it looks freaking amazing, you know?
I haven't seen it, so I can't speak to that, but he got a nomination for House as well, didn't he?
Yeah, because I think he was, you know, we were talking about, like, producing directors, you know, a couple weeks ago, and I believe he was the producing director on House, and House got nominated for Best Drama, so he got nominated for that. But he's done a lot of television shows, including Party of Five, which I love. I love Party of Five so much. Beverly Hills, 90210, Seventh Heaven, Chicago Hope, another great show. Buffy.
That was a great show.
Yeah, right? David E. Kelly. And he's done a lot of David E. Kelly shows. He did Buffy and Angel, Judging Amy, Roswell again.
There you go.
Boston Public, which may be my favorite David E. Kelly show.
That was a good show. I didn't watch it all the time, but I remember catching a couple episodes. I really like that.
Oh man, I wish they'd release that on DVD. I need that show so badly. The Practice and Ally McBeal, which were a great, you know, sort of yin and yang for David E. Kelly.
That's a good way to describe that.
Like, he wrote, like, all the episodes of both, and they were both, like, the same premise, but one was a wacky comedy and one was a hardcore drama. They crossed over, and they both won Best Drama and Best Comedy in the same year at the Emmys one year, which is, I don't know, I love that. He did American Dreams, Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Oh, my God, that show was so good. So good.
Yes, another short-lived, really good show.
CSI, Homeland.
Which, the first two seasons of Homeland were wonderful. I have not watched the third. Did I watch the third season? Everything, honestly, with Homeland, everything started blending.
Yeah.
I think I saw only the first two seasons, but I really enjoyed them.
I need to see that show. I mean, I love 24, and I know a lot of the 24 people went over to make Homeland, and... I need to see that show.
Yeah, it's good. It's worth it.
Yeah. American Horror Story. Hannibal, which is a...
One episode.
Brian Fuller. Now, which episode was this?
I can't pronounce any of the names in this season of Hannibal.
I guess if we're having trouble with Semel.
Takiyawasi? Takiyawase?
I don't know.
Yeah, Takiyawase. Correct me. Feel free. I have no idea. But it's the beehive one, if anybody, because I actually looked it up because I was like, oh, wait, which one was that? Yeah, it's the beehive one. And if anybody's seen the beehive one, yeah, it stays with you. I mean, the thing is, I sound repetitive, though, because I talk about other episodes of Hannibal. I'm like, oh, that sticks with you. Yes, that's a theme with Hannibal. But it's the beehive one with Amanda Plummer, and it is... It's really unique, man. It's really unique what the killer does in that episode.
I need to watch that show. I need to finish up Wonder Falls and get on the rest of Fuller's filmography.
I highly encourage that.
He did The Strain, which is another show you watch.
The Box and Gone Smooth, okay, which are early setup shows. It's before Ephraim... shaves his head. It's very early on, but they're both very good episodes at world building and reveals, actually.
Yeah, was it Del Toro directed the pilot and then he came on for like the next episode or something like that?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
The first few episodes of The Strain are so good at world building. Like seeing that he worked on those is really, I think, important because they brought in somebody that's really adept at taking whatever, you know, hour long time frame you have and just cramming a ton of story into it and never making it feel crowded.
Well, as far as pilots are concerned, he seems to be like a go-to guy when it comes to directing pilots. He's like the wolf from Pulp Fiction. You know, if you need to get something done and you need to make sure that it's done right, you call up David Semel to direct your pilot, and it's almost like a guarantee that it's like that thing's going to get on the air. He directed pilots for Life, Person of Interest, Madam Secretary, The Man in the High Castle, Code Black, and the upcoming David E. Kelly show, Goliath. Pretty cool stuff in there. And he also directed a movie, Lone Star State of Mind, which I haven't seen.
I haven't seen it either, but I have a silly feeling that maybe it's in our future.
We might look at it. You never know. But... You know, he also did something which is very near and dear to my heart. I mean, you look at this filmography and it's like, wow, you know, he's done some amazing shows and he's done some very high profile work. But to me, the thing which stood out, the thing where I was like, oh my God, time to get excited, time to get unreasonably excited, was when I saw that he was a director of Dawson's Creek. A lot of episodes of Dawson's Creek, but very specifically, he directed the first season finale of Dawson's Creek. Now, I love very, very specifically season one of Dawson's Creek, and I feel like that tells like a complete story. And like season two, I'm like, why are we still watching this? I thought that the way that season one ended was perfect. And I have said on many, many occasions that the first season finale of Dawson's Creek is damn near flawless filmmaking. I'm a really big fan of high school melodrama. I think that it's that high school is sort of like the perfect like microcosm for society. Because you've got like everything, all of the elements of society at play, like shoved into one building. And I think that that's kind of like perfect. And I think that season one, Dawson's Creek, I don't know, maybe it's because I was like in high school when it aired. And that was sort of like, you know, I could totally relate to what's going on. I wanted to be a filmmaker. I was Dawson, just, you know, not nearly as pretty.
Whoa, hey. I won't stand for that talk.
Okay.
That is untrue.
All right. Fair enough. You didn't see me in high school, so you know. but yeah, Dawson's Creek, season one finale. Fantastic. I was so excited. I rewatched it last night.
See, you and I are very different people, Mike. I mean, I think people have sussed that out over time.
Perhaps.
But I'm sitting here talking about, Hannibal, yeah, the killer with the beehive and turning people into bees. And you're like, high school melodrama. It's the greatest thing.
And I mean,
I love that about us. I love that about us.
And I'm sure that when I get to Hannibal, I'm going to love that stuff too. And I love Silence of the Lambs and I love Manhunter and I love Hannibal the movie. You know, it's an amazing movie.
It exists.
But I also love Dawson's Creek, you know? And I get excited because it's like, oh, you know, that show. And you know, like on that show, I'd be like, oh, you know, this episode's directed by the guy who did Halloween H2O. And this show is run by the guy who wrote Scream. And the Scream ripoff episode or whatever is directed by Rodman Flender, the director of Idle Hands and Leprechaun 2. But now to think that, yes, you know, maybe the best episode of the show is from the director of, you know, the new Star Trek series or vice versa, that makes me super excited. So,
you know what I love, though? What I absolutely love is the fact that we can get this excited about it, looking at the creators. I think that is so true. That, you know, that speaks so much to the mission of our show. of not just getting excited because there's a Star Trek series coming out, or, oh, hey, there's going to be a spaceship, or, oh, hey, what timeline it's going to be on. But, oh, you know, this person wrote that, this person directed this. And so we can get excited because, I mean, even if you haven't seen what is apparently the greatest hour of television, which is the Dawson's Creek season one series, season finale.
Yes.
Like, even if you haven't seen that, this guy's resume, like, this is, like you said, that you look at this resume, even if you haven't seen all but one thing on it, you look at it and you say, wow, this guy is really knowing what he's doing. He's, like, this is the guy you, like you said, he's the wolf. You bring him in.
Yeah, I mean, even if no one's seen CSI, you know what CSI is. You know how big right. of a show that is. And it's like, this guy is, you know, big time. But yeah, I mean, looking at all these things, I'm like, oh, that's fantastic. You know, and we can, you know, certainly talk about House now, and that's great. But I mean, the first thing I thought of was, oh, yeah, audio commentary for the first season finale of Dawson's Creek. This is going to be amazing. I can't wait to wax poetic about Dawson's Creek on this Star Trek podcast.
And that's Joey what we do. And Pacey? Were those the character names?
There was Joey, and there was Pacey, and there was Dawson, okay. and there was Jennifer.
I got to be honest. I'm a couple of years older. The only thing I remember is that song from the show.
Well, that was great, but like in the finale.
No, that is not the word I was going to go with for that song, Mike. Do not. No, you couldn't escape that song. That song was like laundry detergent. It was just everywhere.
It was a great song, you know. But this finale is also sort of known for a particularly memorable and very, very skillfully crafted sequence. I mean, extremely skillfully crafted sequence, which was set to Edwin McCain's "I'll Be." You know the song.
I'm sure that I do. There's probably some sort of
You know that song. Yeah. I'm not going to go any further with it.
I know that,
but you know it.
Have we ever heard you sing?
Probably.
This is the
not.
First time that we've heard Mike sing on one of his shows.
It's in my DNA. My mom is a professional singer and organist / piano player for the Catholic Archdiocese. So you know,
there you go.
It's in my blood. I am a musical person, genetically speaking. But yes, not in practice though.
Okay.
Yeah. But yes, Dawson's Creek. Check it out. Season one finale. Amazing.
If you were going to recommend that somebody were to check out in preparation for creator materials, season one of Dawson's Creek or Wonderfalls, which would you say?
Look, I'm really enjoying Wonderfalls. You know, so far I've thought that every episode is pretty great. And I guess maybe perhaps if you want a better idea of the people making this show, like I'm guessing that David Semel isn't like, well, if you're going to watch one episode from my filmography, it's the first season finale of Dawson's Creek. But honestly, like if I'm excited about, you know, one single thing, you know, from all the stuff that these people have done. I mean, is it the very, very best thing that they've ever done? Maybe not, but is it the thing which I am most in love with? Yeah, totally.
Hey, man, I am not judging. You know I am not judging.
Yeah, no, I know.
I just think it's cool.
It's, yeah. But yeah, Dawson's Creek, season one finale, right at the top of the list, I have to say. So,
all right.
Yes.
I'll have to put it in the queue. Revisit Dawson and his creek.
Yes, yes.
Did the creek ever flood?
I don't know, because I've only seen season one. Like, oh, and here's the thing about it. Like, here's the thing about it, and speaks to the quality of that finale. Like, you go through season one, and you're all leading up to this moment, and then you see that episode, and you're like, oh my God, like this is going to be a really long summer. Like I can't wait until season two starts. And then season two starts and you're like, yeah, yeah, no, I mean, I guess really kind of what they are talking about it sort of very metatextually in this, the first season finale, which is like you know, cliffhangers. Oh my God, you know, they're just marketing gimmicks and whatnot, but what if things change and it all goes back to being the same thing? And I feel like you reached a height with that first season finale of Dawson's Creek that I couldn't wait to see what came next. And then when they started it up, I was like, oh, okay, well, yeah, I guess there's really no way that you could live up to the high bar which was set by this one particular episode, and I kind of don't care. And even though I've gone back and watched the first season of Dawson's Creek like 3 times, I have never had any desire to watch season 2. I know that sounds weird, but that's kind of how it is.
So David Semel is so good that it could just blow your socks off so much. Here's hoping he doesn't do that well with the Star Trek Discovery pilot. We want people to watch the second episode.
Yes, yes, yes. And I'm sure he wants people to watch it because I think he was heavily involved in like season 2 of Dawson's Creek. And I'm not saying that he did a bad job or anything like that. I just feel like he, you know, closed the loop. I mean, very, very literally, like, and the way that it's directed is sort of fantastic. Like, there's a lot of mirroring of the first episode of Dawson's Creek season 1 and the last episode of Dawson's Creek season 1, and it really does feel like you're ending a story. They told a really good last chapter in that that story, and whatever. Okay, so we've talked about Dawson's Creek.
You're actually selling me on the idea of actually watching Dawson's Creek.
It's really good. I mean, if you're a fan of movies, you know, I mean, tons of movie references throughout that entire first season.
And Kevin Williamson, not really surprised by that.
No, and I love Kevin Williamson as a writer. And that's one of the reasons why I'm looking forward to this Time After Time show, even though the early reviews coming out of San Diego have not exactly been fantastic, but that doesn't matter.
That's okay.
Me.
The early reviews for the X-Files were okay, I see your point.
Well, you know, I'm not going to touch that because I thought, you know, I mean, my whole take on the X-Files revival is like, you can give me five of the worst hours in television history as long as you give me Mulder and Scully meet the Weremonster, and I'm going to be like,
they met your challenge. They met your challenge, Mike. You said, give me five of the worst hours on TV. And just give me the wear person one. And they said, all right, you know what, Mike, we can do that for you.
And if they want to do that again, I'll be like, do it. Because, you know, that episode is one of the best episodes in television history. And it's one of the best episodes of The X-Files. So, yeah, do it.
If they want to do that again, you can just tell me all about it.
Okay, I will.
Yeah.
I will. And you're missing out, so.
I guess so.
Anyway, perhaps we should wrap this up, shall we?
Let's.
Well, it's been fun talking about Star Trek Beyond. Finally, new Star Trek today. But that's not all we're talking about this week. Well, let's not kid ourselves. That pretty much is everything that anyone's talking about this week.
It's really dominating conversations. It really is.
But here's a look at some of the other shows which may be talking about Star Trek Beyond.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
We've been waiting so long to cover material, and it's still not covered yet. And now we might go to the complete other extreme, and let's just jet through it all as fast as we can.
Damn you, Brian Fuller. You've given us too much Star Trek too fast.
The Orb.
You put your action figures on the table or whatever in your house, you know, they don't move, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I've got one of Picard right over there, and when he doesn't do what I want, I put him in the box, and I put it in the cabinet.
Straighten your shirt, Picard.
Melodic Treks.
Over a period of 18 years, McCarthy composed 257 entries of the various Star Trek series, making him the biggest contributor to the sound of the franchise.
Meta Treks.
Well, I mean, if you're just talking sheer cool, I don't think there's any argument that Worf and Jadzia's wedding was just absolutely cool. There was a dramatic element to it. It wasn't just a ceremony.
Performative bloodletting. Yeah. That's how Klingon weddings go.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond.
Beyond!
And by and beyond, we mean and beyond, yes. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And, of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. As always, we want to thank our associate producers, Jeff Sutter and Chris Steftenagel, for their everlasting support of our small endeavor.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you very much. And if you would like to follow in their footsteps, go to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks we have for you, including early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. And again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you really want to help us out, you could also leave us a review in iTunes. That really sort of like makes everything much more visible for people who are looking for the show and all that good stuff. And hey, we're going to have a little contest for iTunes reviewers.
Yes.
Here on this show. When I went to that screening of the movie, the trilogy, in IMAX, IMAX gave out posters, which were just for that screening. And it's a pretty cool poster. It's got this really cool art of, I think it's Spock and Bones, I think.
Yeah, it looks like Spock and Bones.
And we'll make it the show art for this week so that everyone can kind of take a peek at how great it is. And my friend Matt, who went to the movie with me, was like, hey, you can take this poster and give it away on your podcast. And I thought, oh, that's a great idea. So leave us a review on iTunes, and we'll keep this going through August.
Yeah, August sounds good.
Okay. Yeah, let's announce it on the 50th anniversary show.
That sounds great.
Okay.
Perfect.
All right. Okay, cool. So we have to limit this to America, the United States of America. I apologize.
Sorry, y'all.
Sorry. But yeah, leave us a review, and we appreciate your support. Okay, if you want to contact us, you can find the network on Twitter at TrekFM or on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Or you can hit us up on the Babel Conference, which is Trek FM's listener forum. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. Where can people find you, John?
Kessel Junkie on Twitter and just about everywhere else. You can find me on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast I co-host with Trek FM's own Matt Rushing over on the Nerd Party Network. And on another podcast called Words with Nerds that I co-host with my pal Craig. Where can people find you, Mike?
You can find me right here on Trek FM, producing From There to Here, Trek FM's daily rewatch of Star Trek, all 729 episodes now, from beginning to end. And you can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. All right. Well, we made it to beyond.
We made it beyond where we were before.
Yes. And now we can finally shift our attention fully to the new series, Star Trek Discovery,
which we can discover.
Yeah,
what's coming?
But next week, what we're gonna do, since there is a new Star Trek movie, and I love the fact that there's a new Star Trek movie coming out, we are going to give our picks for who we think should direct it.
Special Trek.fm Earl Grey event announcement for Star Trek Las Vegas. Listeners, You know Bridgemates from Earl Grey episodes 82, 109, and 141, as well as To the Journey 117 and Standard Orbit 102. There is even the original trivia panel show Encounter at All Good Things from Earl Grey 137. So Earl Grey is proud to announce a live presentation of Super Bridgemates at the Star Trek Las Vegas 50th Anniversary Convention on Friday, August 5th, from 12:30 to 1:15 p.m. It will be held at the Roddenberry Stage at Quark's Bar at the Rio. Your favorite team here at Earl Grey of Free Enterprise will attempt to escape defeat, again, against two rival Bridgemate teams, Team Lizard Babies, Charlene Schmidt and Tristan Riddell, and the Council of Mistresses, Andy Vanderkolk and Jarrah Hodge. When it comes to celebrating the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, regular Bridgemates simply won't do. And that's why this game show will be Super Bridgemates, a fun-filled comedic game show involving fans, cosplayers, and audience members. Not only will the teams compete in hilarious trivia, but those in the audience will participate by acting out selected scenes from our favorite Star Trek moments, and cosplayers will help create puzzles for the teams to solve. It's all about the love of Trek. So we hope all the listeners who will be coming to Star Trek Las Vegas will join us, Earl Grey, and all your favorite co-hosts and fellow listeners for Super Bridgemates at Star Trek Las Vegas at the Roddenberry Stage.